I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth has never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. And welcome to this Tuesday edition of A Public Affair. But coming up for the remainder of the hour is one of my favorite guests, and she's Joni Jester, will join us from out in San Francisco. Many of you folks have gotten to know Joni over the last couple of years because she was a prolific presence at the uprising at the Wisconsin Capitol. She was one of those folks who was actually motivated in the early days to fly out here to Madison to lend a hand and to help to document this important history. But Joni's love affair with the state of Wisconsin goes back at least a decade or more before that, and that's connected to her work as a filmmaker. A very important film that documents a piece of New Deal history. There were groups of immigrants from Wisconsin, Minnesota, from throughout the Midwest during that time in the 1930s that migrated north to the Matanuska Valley of Alaska. And the film that she has co-produced with Paul Hill, Alaska Far Away, documents that important history. It's aired in recent years on public television networks throughout the country, including here in Madison, and is expected back on the air in Madison early this summer. Hey, Joni Jester, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you, John. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, it's great to have you here. I know you were going to check in with public TV. We're still a little bit tentative. Do we know if we have a date pinned down yet for Wisconsin Public TV broadcast?
We do not yet have a specific date for Wisconsin Public Television, but we are very excited to be coming back there. And believe me, we'll be spreading the word as soon as we get that date pinned down. It will also be shown on Wisconsin Public Milwaukee Public Television as well.
Which many folks know is sort of a separate network. So yes, yeah, we'll do our best to get out the word there.
So between the two, we'll be covering Wisconsin shortly, probably in June, but I'll let you know the date as soon as we hear it.
And we'll be sure to emphasize this a little later in the hour too. But why don't we at the outset just establish the website where folks can find out more about this project and its history?
Yes, well, thanks to all the social media out there. You can find us in a lot of places. First of all, we have a Facebook page, Alaska Far Away, and where we post, you know, quick updates every time a new station signs on. And I should mention that the reason we're having this conversation is because Alaska Far Away has been picked up by American Public Television. And so far, 72 public television stations from coast to coast have signed on to show our film. And we are delighted that Wisconsin is among the states that's, where it will be shown. So we're doing a lot of updates these days on our Facebook page, Alaska Far Away, on Twitter, Alaska Far Away, and our website, AlaskaFarAwayTheMovie.com.
Once again, AlaskaFarAwayTheMovie.com is probably right. One of the best for one-stop shopping there, find out about all of this. Well, I wanted to establish this at the outset, sort of the timeline for this project. This is one of those things you embarked on. I think, you know, as you've explained in the past, you know, now with eyes wide open, but maybe not realizing at the time how this would really just become a major emphasis of your life. But the history of this production goes back quite a ways, right?
My mother always said that patience was a virtue, and she was right. We first started working on this film when my friend Paul and I flew to Alaska just on a lark, just for vacation in February of 1994. I had never seen real snow, being from the San Francisco Bay Area. And we had a friend up there to visit, our friend Jim Fox, who lived in the little town of Palmer, Alaska, which is about 45 minutes outside of Anchorage. So we went to stay with Jim for a few days, and he was living with his grandmother, Irene Benson, lovely, funny, fabulous woman, and a really, really good cook. And she was one of the original Matanuska colonists who was sent up from the Midwest to the Matanuska Valley in 1935 by the federal government as part of a New Deal project to settle Alaska, to help people from the Midwest who were on relief and suffering from the Great Depression. And there were some other objectives to this project as well, which we'll get deeper into it during this interview. But anyhow, after 3 days of listening to Irene's stories and eating her fabulous moose burgers and strawberry rhubarb pie, we looked at each other and said, this should be a film. Why have we never heard of this amazing episode in American history that the government was resettling, relocating its citizens to other parts of the country to help them escape the Depression? So amazingly enough, we both bought into this idea, and I quit my day job, and Paul fortunately did not. One of us had to keep working. And we started working on the film right away. This was 1994, before some of your listeners were born. It ended up taking 14 years to complete the film. We finished the film in 2008, started showing it at film festivals around the country, including the Wisconsin Film Festival, where it won the Jury Prize. And then it was shown on some public television stations at that time in 2008 and 2009. This year, American Public Television came back to us and said, hey, we'd like to show this film again. We'd like to offer it to our stations. And all of a sudden, it's being picked up all over. And we're so excited that the film is finding new audiences, finding new life around the country.
Well, let's see, we could just talk a little bit about the connection to Wisconsin. And am I telling tales correctly here that what the film was, in fact, a catalyst for you to become familiar with Wisconsin and perhaps some of the aspects of our progressive history, I think you were telling me also last night, it was also it made you aware that Fighting Bob La Follette had a role in bringing those migrants from Wisconsin to Alaska. Is that right?
Well, it is indeed true that this film brought Wisconsin to my consciousness. I had never visited Wisconsin, didn't know much about it, but during the course of the film, it's like a crash course in graduate-level history. We started working with historians around the country, including the remarkable Jack Holzhäder, who was with the State Historical Society of Wisconsin for umpteen years and a major radio presence in Wisconsin. And he was instrumental in filling us in on Wisconsin history and everything from its geography to its politics. Also, Professor Arnold Allenan of the University of Wisconsin, he's now retired. He was a professor of landscape architecture. And he was instrumental in helping us get the film made and indeed shows up at the beginning of the film talking about the cutover region, which is a very interesting part of Wisconsin's history. So, yes, we started visiting Wisconsin, traveling around, doing our research, interviewing people, and fell in love with the state. Now, of course, Fighting Bob La Follette was passed away in the 20s, but his son, Phil La Follette, was governor of Wisconsin in the 1930s, and he was instrumental in having Wisconsin be a part of the Matanuska Project. Phil La Follette and the governors of Wisconsin, of Michigan and Minnesota, all petitioned President Roosevelt to be part of this planned expedition to Alaska. At the time, Washington was already looking at a way to help colonize Alaska, and they were looking at tying this in with relief efforts in the United States. So the governors of those three states petitioned President Roosevelt and said, look up here. We've got the people that you need. We've got hardy pioneer stock who are used to cold climates, difficult conditions, farming in northern climates, and they desperately need your help. So let's talk about getting these people up to Alaska and seeing if we can help them. So, yes, the La Follette legacy passed down to Phil, and he helped get the Wisconsinites to Alaska. There were, and I'm going to have to look it up because, of course, I've got my computer open while I'm talking to you. There were 68 families from Wisconsin who were chosen to be part of this project. That's in addition to 67 families from Minnesota and 68 families from Michigan. So a total of, by our count, over 200 families, just under 1,000 people total with the kids, who were sent up en masse to Alaska, 78 years ago, right about now, actually, the first colonists arrived in the Matanuska Valley on May 10th, 1935.
Important anniversary date here, yeah.
Yep.
And so we've kind of established, you know, the Midwestern kind of roots of this. Mm-hmm. We can flesh out just a little bit more what kind of a landscape these folks were moving into, both in terms of what they faced then and what the Matanuska Valley is like now.
Well, actually, John, let me start by talking about where they came from.
Sure.
Because northern Wisconsin and Minnesota and Michigan at that time were very different from what they are now, in the sense that at that point they were the northern counties of those three states were collectively known as the Cutover Region. And that's because this is the region that supplied the great where the great forest that supplied the wood that built America. You know, this was where the logging was king. Logging and mining were huge industries there in the late 19th century, early 20th century. But by about the 1920s, the forests were gone. They were clear cut. They were cut over, and there were just miles and miles and miles of nothing but stumps. And by then, most of the mines were played out. So suddenly, these places that had been boom towns and just massive amounts of people pouring into them to work in the forests and in the mines, they were devastated. There was no employment. We have seen relief maps drawn in 1934, 1935 that showed some counties with 70% unemployment. I came across a statistic last night, and I'm looking to find where I found it, but showed that of the people who were living in northern Wisconsin at that time, many of them in 1934 had an annual income of $300 cash.
Mm.
I mean, there were no opportunities, and often the land after the trees were cut, the land wasn't any good for farming. You know, it was very far north. A lot of it was sandy, bad soil, whatever. And people were stuck up there with no resources to either find jobs where they were or the money to move. So the tax delinquency rate was going through the roof, and the area was stranded. Now, most of us have seen many, many times the photos from the Depression of bread lines in the major cities, and we've seen pictures of the Dust Bowl and of sharecroppers in the South. And that's because photographers were sent to those areas, and they documented those well. There weren't a lot of people photographing the northern counties in the Midwest. These were, you know, distant, isolated places, and they weren't being documented very well. So we don't have those images in our head, but trust me, these areas were very, very difficult. And the stories we've heard from the colonists there would curl your hair. Just so sad to hear that they had no way to feed their families. One man said, when you can't find work and the kids need something to eat, what are you going to do? You got to ask for help. And so people had to look for relief. And this is where the New Deal came along. So here we had people in this stranded, isolated area who were desperately in need of help and needed a place to go, needed some way to get jump-started. They weren't going to find opportunities where they were. The government comes along and says, hey, we'll pay your way to Alaska. We'll pay your way, get you set up on a farm, 40 acres, we'll build you a house, a barn, get you started with some farm animals and some credit to get you going. And you've got 30 years to pay the government back at 3%. It's a pretty sweet deal. So where they were going to, the Matanuska Valley, like I said, is very close to Anchorage, but in those days, there weren't any roads. Mm. You know, it was quite a trek to get out there. The Alaska Railroad had been built in the teens, and it passed through the Matanuska Valley. There was already settlement there. First of all, of course, the Dena'ina, the Athabascan natives, had been there for centuries. They were nomadic people. They moved with the seasons, following the fish, the berries, whatever, and whatever employment they could get. There were mines, the Independence Mine, the copper mines, the coal mines, were flourishing up in the mountains. And there was also homesteading that was opened up to homesteading in the teens. So there was settlement there, but it was very small. It was very sparse. There wasn't much infrastructure there to support the people who were there. And most of the settlers were, a lot of them were old bachelors who had been gone up to Alaska during the gold rush and decided to stay and try to make a go of it on a homestead. Well, a single guy on 160 acres isn't going to get very far out in the middle of nowhere. So a lot of people abandoned their places. So it was a difficult, remote area, not completely unsettled, but largely unsettled. So when and of course at that point it was a territory, not a state. So when the United States purchased Alaska from Russia in the 19th century, for a large amount of time, Alaska just kind of sat there undeveloped. The U.S. didn't really know what to do with it. So the Matanuska colony represents the first real investment, large-scale investment by the U.S. government to help bring population to Alaska.
Yeah.
It is, by the way, one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. Absolutely stunningly beautiful. I encourage you to go visit it. Someday, John, get up there and see it. It's so stunningly beautiful. Beautiful valley floor surrounded by remarkable mountains all around. And it's just a lovely, lovely place, and with a relatively temperate climate.
And, Joni, I'm going to interrupt you for just a second so we can take a call, but just to, again, establish sort of the geography of it, this is roughly, it's the land essentially between Anchorage and what we now call Denali, Mount McKinley, and so it's while it was remote, it's now actually, one of the more populated areas of Alaska, and it's also, as you said, a temperate climate, famous for these huge vegetables that are grown there.
It is world famous for its giant cabbages and other giant vegetables, which are on display each August at the Alaska State Fair.
Exactly.
And I believe Discovery Channel and other channels have taken to going up there each year for the giant cabbage way off. Last year's cabbage set a world record of over 136 pounds.
All right. I just want to establish one other theme that we hope to explore throughout the remainder of the hour is talking about the significance of this at a time when government hadn't necessarily interceded on behalf of folks who were either the victims of floods, the victims of poverty, all the other things that were happening during this Depression era. And so there was really a decision that was being made, a very strong debate that was occurring. It's kind of resonant with what's happening in Congress now in terms of reexamining what government's role is. And so we hope to explore that theme as well. But let's bring our caller on if we can. Caller, your comment or question, please, for Joni Jester.
Hello?
Yes, please go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thanks for this program. Joni, I agree with everything you say. My name is Griffin, and I'm a veteran of the Korean War, now age 80. My degree from UCLA is in theater and film way back in the 50s. Joni Woman, you've created a positive document. I'll hang up now. Your voice is beautiful, but don't tell nobody. Aloha.
Okay.
Thank you, Griffin. Thank you for your support.
All right.
I hope you get to see the film on Wisconsin Public Television or whichever station is close to you.
Well, hey, with that endorsement, Joni, actually, this might be a good place to share a segment from the trailer, just to give people a sense of the pace and the flow and some of the interviews that are part of this. This is a video trailer, and I think a lot of the action takes place during a parade that's passing through Palmer and some of the big towns up there. It's kind of colorful, and folks go to YouTube and just check out Alaska Far and Away, and you'll find this. But anyway, some of the music, some of the comments that folks make give folks a sense of what the documentary is all about. So let's share that if we could, and then we'll come back and take the narrative a little further along.
I just love this little town of Palmer, Alaska. It's my hometown, and I just think it's the prettiest little town ever. I'm awfully glad my parents were colonists.
Well, I was a year old, and my dad came back and asked my mother, how'd you like to go to Alaska? She said, sure, why not? A week later, they were on the train depot at Mille Lacs heading for San Francisco.
As a 15-year-old kid, every day in the paper there was something about Palmer, Alaska, the Kamanuska colony up here. Man, that was exciting, I'll tell you. The colony itself was trying to create a feeling of hope in the American people by recreating the frontier, which it did.
Farms in Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, 1,500 men, women, and children are moving. Uncle Sam is lending the money. He's taking them to greener pastures in Alaska, to fertile land, normal climate. Here's one family ready to go.
I hope when we get in Alaska that things will be better up there and I can make a living without asking anyone for help.
I'll do my best to make a real home for my family.
For years, life here has been severe. But in Alaska, 40 acres of land for each family, a $3,000 loan, farm equipment, a new chance to live.
And we've been listening to the film trailer for Alaska Far and Away, the New Deal pioneers of the Matanuska colony. Our guest on the line is Joni Juster. She was one of the filmmakers, along with Paul Hill, of this documentary film. It started almost 2 decades ago, long production, the film first airing on public television stations across the country in 2008, 2009. It's making an encore visit to public television stations, including Wisconsin Public TV, coming up early this summer. Still trying to pin down that exact date, and we'll keep you appraised of it. Just also want to mention once again, Alaska Far Away, themovie.com is a website where you can keep up to date on when this will air in this area and other very interesting details about the film. 608-256-2001. Is the number if you'd like to call and be part of the contribution kind of conversation. As we mentioned, Joni also a very familiar person to many of you who's very involved as someone who flew in from San Francisco to be part of the Wisconsin Capitol uprising, actually slept at the Capitol many nights and was here for the recall election and many points in between. Well, Joni, as we listen to the documentary, you're remarking that this is a piece of history that was little known at the time because a lot of the cameras, a lot of the attention was down in Dust Bowl areas, down in the major cities where there were soup lines and other things. But as this group moved into the Matanuska Valley, it strikes me that there were reporters who followed. We kind of heard some of the audio from newsreels. Was there, in fact, more attention paid once the group was underway?
Boy, was there ever. This was headline news all across the country. It was not only on the front pages of every newspaper, but it was on the editorial pages of every newspaper being hotly debated as to whether this was a wonderful example of pioneerism or pinko commie socialism.
Okay.
They one minute the colonists were being lauded as pioneers and the next they were being degraded as plush bottom cream puffs. So this was a very hot topic in those days, and it was debated on the floor of the Congress almost every day. Now, I should say that the Matanuska colony was not unique. It was unique in some ways. But it was not the only colony that was established during that time. This was one of over 100 resettlement communities that were created by the New Deal. And this is the piece of history that most people are missing, and because it has dropped away from the history books. Unless you are a New Deal scholar or a real serious historian, you're not going to know about this. But there were over 100 resettlement communities created across the United States. They were of various types. Some of them were what they've called farming communities, like the Matanuska Colony, where people were resettled from submarginal farmland to a nearby, most of them were to nearby areas where the farmland was better, set up on better farms, and again given reasonable terms to pay the government back for this leg up. Some of them were industrial communities where they the government would create a an industry like a furniture company or some sort of small factory where people could make a living while setting them up in decent housing and planned communities. Some of them were garden communities. Greendale, Wisconsin is one of these New Deal resettlement communities, has a wonderful history. There was another one in northern Wisconsin in called the Drummond Project in Bayfield. Some of you know Austin, Minnesota. Also, Albert Lea, both of those were industrial communities. And some of them were called stranded communities. And that was areas where it just didn't look like people had any hope of ever regaining a living wage or any way to feed their families once the Depression hit. Many of these were company towns where the core industry in that town had failed or moved, and the people left behind were stranded. They had nothing to do once the industry was gone.
And we'll have a chance to expand on this point again, but it was something relatively new to think about government and having this kind of role in terms of interceding in the plight of folks who were facing poverty, all these other challenges. You know, as recently as the late 1920s, when massive floods swept the Mississippi Valley, there was a debate. You know, do we care about this as a nation? Is that something that we are going to put national resources into to helping folks? It wasn't a done deal, and so this was a very important turning point in our nation's history. So we'll have a chance to come back in just a second and elaborate more on that. Sandy, we do have a caller on the line. Caller, your comment, your question, please.
Yeah, hello. I found this discussion fascinating. I've got a few quick comments, though. I guess I've seen a lot of this area from the program Alaska State Troopers. Now, obviously, that's not an authoritative documentary source, but it does depict the area, so one gets a good look at the geography of the area, but also the fact that there are a lot of problems there, obviously poverty and most of the other types of criminal behavior that are associated with that. Another question, this is the area that Sarah Palin hails from, and yep. If I'm not mistaken, didn't her family originally come from the Midwest and settle in the area? And then one other concern I have, you mentioned that these communities were established during the Depression, and I'm wondering to what extent is the fact of resettling people in remote areas a form of a cop-out rather than taking on the issues, which in the case of the Depression was just an absence of money among the bulk of the population. But rather than tackling the root of the problem, it might be so much easier just to send these people to Alaska or northern Wisconsin or wherever, rather than working at what the root of the issue is. And I'll take my comments off the air, and I hope to be able to see this documentary soon. Bye.
Thanks for your call. Hey, let's parse these out if we could, Joni. So the notion of watching on cable TV and seeing some of the crime-related programs and things that take place up there, you know, some of that may be exaggerated, but on the other hand, this really still is the frontier in some ways. It's a place where people kind of pride themselves on their individuality, and sometimes that means maybe some disregard for other folks. I don't know. I mean, do you think there's something to be said for his observation?
Oh, absolutely. And I was making notes during his call because he brought up several points, and I want to answer all of them. First of all, I think what he may be referring to, I haven't seen Alaska State Troopers, but I certainly know, am familiar with the crime problems in the valley, and Wasilla is known as the meth capital of Alaska. There's the same problems that you find in rural areas, in impoverished areas all over the country, where people often turn to crime, and it's sad, but it's contemporary problems hit everywhere, even the most beautiful areas.
Yeah.
So, secondly, regarding Sarah Palin, this is something that became very interesting when our film came out. It was 2008, an election year, right? And and suddenly the governor of Alaska was in the news everywhere. And if you Googled Sarah Palin's accent, everybody was talking about why this governor from Alaska had a Midwestern sounding accent. Mm. And it's because most they were not, her family was not originally from the Midwest. I think she came from Idaho, but everybody else in the valley, so many of the people from in the valley settled there from the Midwest, that if you go to the Matanuska Valley, a lot of people have Midwestern accents, and so that's where she picked that up. So she, you know, she spent much of her formative years there. So it is very common to hear a Midwestern twang in the Matanuska Valley, and she certainly, I think, exaggerated that, you know, some in the press when she was speaking publicly, and because it sounded more down-to-earth, more folksy. But her accent has actually been studied by academics right there at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. There have been academic studies written of her accents, and it's
sure.
That go back to the Matanuska colony.
Dictionary project trying to capture, I think, dialects throughout the U.S., and so that would make
exactly,
sense.
Exactly.
Hey, well, before we leave that topic, so you had this interesting intersection that was unplanned in 2008. Your film's coming out at a time when Sarah Palin and Alaska are suddenly in the news. How did that affect the impact that your film had, or the discussions around it?
Well, it certainly, I think, brought a little more attention to us. You know, we're a pretty small production company, so we weren't on anybody's radar. While she was, on headlines everywhere. However, our film did debut at the Alaska State Fair in August of 2008 on Governor's Day, and the governor was there, and so I went up and had my picture taken with her. And a couple of days later, all of a sudden, she was one of the most famous people in the world.
Wow.
At the time I had my picture taken with her, she was just Sarah from down the road. So it was just a moment in time, shall we say. I have this surreal picture of myself with her. It was just a moment in time.
And she was the mayor at the time of Wasilla?
She was the governor.
She's the governor. Excuse me. Oh, she was the governor then. Okay.
But it's Alaska is the biggest state in the union. It's 2.5 times the size of Texas. It's absolutely enormous, but it's also the biggest small town in the world. The population is less than half of San Francisco, spread out over this enormous area. So pretty much everybody knows everybody, or knows somebody who knows somebody. So it's very connected. It's very connected. And that's one of the things that I find so fascinating about the place, is that in a place that's so remote, even in this day of global communications and airplanes and everything, Alaska is still very far away. It takes forever to fly there. Can't drive there very easily, certainly not quickly. It is physically remote from the rest of the continental United States.
Yeah.
And so people, and the climate, even though it's comparatively moderate, it's still Alaska. And so people have to depend on each other. You have to be able to depend on your neighbors. The single most important quality to have up there is to be a good neighbor, to be someone that that you can depend on each other. Whatever your politics, whatever your other differences of opinion may be, as long as you're a good neighbor, you're okay.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's a place that you've really fallen in love with in a lot of different ways, and we'll have a chance to explore that. Yeah, there was also a third part to our last caller's question I want to come back to in just a moment about sort of
right.
the ethics of resettlement and whether that was a good strategy. And that fits, I think, into our larger discussion about the role of government in all of this. But in the meantime, we do have another caller. 608-256-2001 is the number for all of you to participate. But caller, your comment, your question, please, for Joni Jester.
I was just wondering if you ever saw the Folklore Theater up in Peninsula Park puts on plays, and one of their most popular plays that's got played a few times since 2000 is Lumberjacks in Love, and it's about it's a play about early Wisconsin when all these people were kind of hoodwinked into coming into Wisconsin and found all this land up in northern Wisconsin terrible to farm with. And I think at the end of it, they do talk about some of them were going to Alaska because they couldn't make a living there.
Caller, do you know, was that the early 1900s or way back, maybe even pre-territorial days for Wisconsin?
It was after the cutover.
Okay, after the cutover. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things I discovered a while back is I have a Quinlan ancestor who was a lumberjack in the 1830s in Wisconsin, so I'm curious about how that history attaches. But yeah, Joni, are you aware of that film by chance, or of that, that play by chance?
It's so funny that you should mention it. I'm so glad that you brought up the Folklore Theater because of the late, great Fred Alley and the very, very still with us and great Jimmy Kaplan wrote... have written many shows for the Folklore Theater, including Lumberjacks in Love, which I believe is being they're putting up a production now, I believe, in Milwaukee. I think it's in rehearsals now. But they also did another show that was specifically about the Wisconsinites who went to Alaska for the Matanuska colony, and I was made aware of this by sheer coincidence in 1994, just as we were starting our film. I was working with a young lady at my job, and I was telling her about the film, and she says, "Oh, that's funny. A friend of mine back in Wisconsin just wrote a musical about that." And so I became acquainted with Fred and Jimmy by email at the time, and Jimmy Kaplan, who is still producing these shows, wonderful, wonderful person. He's a very dear friend. I've never actually met him in person, but boy, we have a great online relationship. And so the Folklore Theater has done a brilliant job over the years of bringing Wisconsin's history to life on the stage.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to see it myself, but what I've read about it just sounds like it's a real hoot and actually rooted in some important history there too. So sounds like a great play to check out. 608-256-2001 is the number if you'd like to join in our conversation. Again, we're talking about Alaska Far Away, a documentary that was many, many years in the making, came out in about 2008-2009, first time played on public TV stations all around the country. And it's making an encore performance on public television stations all across the country, including coming to Wisconsin Public TV, Milwaukee Public TV, a little later in the summer. Date is yet to be announced, but Alaska Far Away, themovie.com is a place where you can follow this and learn more about some of the important history. And Joni, so we wanted to, two callers ago, there was one other area that caller had asked about that I think is a fascinating dilemma. When I've talked to you before, I think you all decided as filmmakers maybe not to necessarily weigh in with a conclusion to this question, but you do raise it, and you do bring voices into the film that debate this. So what about this idea of transporting all these folks? I mean, part of the government's motivation was to settle the territory, but is it possible that some of those decisions were made, sometimes not with always the best interest of the folks that were making the move involved?
As with any decision made by the government, there are always multiple reasons behind it, right? And when we started looking at the history of the Matanuska colony, when we decided to make the film, we were looking for that moment of decision. You know, who made the decision? How was this decision made? Where did this idea come from? And we never found one place, but we found a confluence of ideas. And I want to explore that for just a moment. First of all, in Washington, in Washington D.C., you had Roosevelt and his brains trust. He had the best and the brightest who were trying to come up with ideas to help so many Americans who were distressed by the Depression. So the New Deal was created. All these various and sundry projects. They were throwing ideas at the wall to see what would stick, and they were never meant to be. Most of them, and I want to qualify that because, of course, Social Security is still with us. But most of them were meant to be temporary solutions to an emergency situation. They were not meant to be long-term solutions. Okay, so they were coming up with all sorts of creative ideas just to see what would work, just to get people moving now. One of my very favorite quotes that did not make it into the film was from Harry Hopkins, who is widely known as Roosevelt's right-hand man. He was chosen to lead the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, the FERA, which created so many of these relief projects. And he was asked once by one of his critics, he said, "Harry, you're throwing all this money at these projects. They're not going to work in the long run." And Harry said, "People don't eat in the long run. They eat every day." His job, his mission, his goal was to get people eating now, to get people working now, and to give people the dignity of work and self-sustenance rather than relief. So the idea was to create projects that would get people working, get people putting food on the table themselves, give them the leg up that they couldn't get on their own at that moment, and then they could become self-sustaining. I've got a quote here in front of me from October 1934. From the Rural Rehabilitation Project. Boy, try saying that three times.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah, go ahead.
It says, "It is the belief of this administration that the Rural Rehabilitation Program will be effective in restoring to at least partial self-support a major portion of the affected families." So it was to give them the opportunity to become self-sustaining, even partially. If they gave somebody an acre of land and a decent little house, they could grow their own vegetables, they could raise some chickens, they could at least be partially self-sustaining. So that was part of it. Again, while this was going on in Washington, in the Midwest, you had the governors of these three states huddling together saying, "How can we help our people in these stranded communities up north who were lured up there," as he said, from Lumberjacks in Love. They were lured up there with the promise of jobs, with the promise of cheap land, and then they found themselves stuck in communities where they couldn't make a living and they couldn't feed their families. I mean, maybe you can grow your own vegetables, but you can't grow shoes for the kids' feet. You can't grow food, money for the taxes. You can't grow a lot of things. Meanwhile, in Alaska, you've got this territory that had been sitting there for a long time, neglected by Washington. They built a railroad, but they didn't have markets. They didn't have people to sustain the railroad. They had all this land that could be developed and all these resources, but they couldn't get people up there to live there and stay there because it was just too difficult as an individual settler to go up there. So having the support of a government project, bringing people up en masse and building the infrastructure to make it possible for them to succeed, this was something they petitioned the government for. So we've got the impetus in Alaska, which was trying to settle their own land. You've got the people in the Midwest who had people who needed some help. And you've got Washington trying to coordinate the whole thing.
I apologize, we're running a little short on time. I want to come back to some of the parallels with the present day in just a second. But to play the other side of the question then, were a lot of the critiques, though, that perhaps they underestimated what a daunting place this was and how very unsettled it was and what they were subjecting young children and families to?
And bear in mind that the whole project came together extremely quickly. The money for the Matanuska colony was authorized by Congress on March 9, 1935. By the end of April, colonists were already on the train on their way. when they got to the Matanuska colony on May 10th, there weren't any houses ready for them. Some tents had been built for them, but the work crews that had been sent ahead to prepare for them had only arrived a couple of days before them. So it was very hastily thrown together. And they did the best they could, but as anybody who's ever done any sort of construction project knows, if you do try to do something that big on that short a notice, things are going to go awry.
Joni, we have another caller on the line. We want to make sure we get that comment or question recognized, and then we'll come back to try to summarize in just a moment. Caller, your comment or question, please, for Joni Jester.
Well, hi. Yeah, I used to go up there every summer to Alaska to fish, and I was amazed how many Wisconsin people, Minnesota people I ran into. And, in fact, that was how I was able to get jobs, by reconnecting or connecting with other Midwesterners. And I'm curious to know the overall percentage now who are, like, descendants of these three states, and also if, you know, ex-Governor Palin, if that's where she gets her accent. She sounds like she's from Minnesota.
All right. Thanks for your question. Go ahead, Joni.
The Matanuska Valley and, of course, Alaska in general are filled with the descendants of the colonists. Now, with the, like I said, there were just under 1,000 of them who went up in 1935. Of those 200 and some odd families who went up, about half left within the first year. It was very difficult. And so the government had promised them that if they wanted to go home within the first year, the government would pay their way back. After the first year, they had to pay their own way. So a lot of them left within the first summer, especially when an epidemic broke out among the children, and and three children died within a few days of each other. That scared a lot of people, as you can imagine, being so far from home. So a lot of families left.
Joni, I apologize.
A lot of families left when they saw, you know, they were on 40 acres of uncleared land, and they had to clear the land before they could grow anything. So those who stayed prospered, and they have their descendants are everywhere.
Coming down to just our last couple minutes, I just want to emphasize again for folks who want to know more about this film project and then can follow when it will be airing on Wisconsin Public Television later this summer, Alaska Far Away the Movie, alaskafarawaythemovie.com is the place you can find out that. Joni, we're down to just a couple minutes, but could you relate this to the extent that you can, a complicated subject? Does this resonate, this theme of what is government's role in providing relief for folks that are in distress and poverty? Is that something that you see resonant with the here and now?
Oh, absolutely. It's still being hotly debated on the floor of Congress absolutely every day. This is something that it's an issue that will never go away. How appropriate is it for government to have, you know, such an intimate role in the lives of its citizens? It's something that is always relevant. And the other, you know, relevant theme that that our film addresses, everyone can relate to the need to find a better life for your family. Most of us come from immigrants who have come from some other country at some point, you know, wherever in history, who came to America looking for a better life for their country. That's what these people did. They went to Alaska, not, you know, maybe looking for adventure, but mostly just trying to find a better life for their family. It's something we can all relate to.
Did you make connections as you were up here at the Wisconsin protests to some of these themes? Again, what is government's role? What was its responsibility? I've heard you talk about it. I know that was a common thread as you were protesting what the Walker administration, what others have done. It was being to take responsibility for folks who were in need.
Well, yes, when you've got a population who are suffering, and you know, the country has been going through, you know, its own recession or depression, depending on the difference between a recession and depression is whether you still have your job or not. We've been going through hard times these past few years, and we've all been looking for answers. How do we help ourselves, and how do we help each other? How does the government help us? Is it appropriate for the government to help us? I wouldn't have made this
Joni,
film, obviously, if I didn't think that the last answer was the right one.
And on that note, we need to close out here again. Joni Jester has been our guest. She is a co-producer along with Paul Hill of Alaska Far Away, a film that will be airing on Wisconsin Public Television later this summer, Alaska Far Away, themovie.com, the place where you can find out more. Joni, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
And this has been a public affair.